Hey, Summit Church. Good to be back with you. This is Kyle Eastep, and we're continuing our conversation about demonic activity that was presented in Mark's gospel and trying to answer some of the questions that were submitted to us. And today it's my privilege to have with us Brian Onken. Brian is the academic director of the River Upstate and a faithful member at Summit Simpsonville, teaches for us quite regularly around Summit. And we've known him for quite some time. Super thankful for his participation in this with us and even in helping us continue to really think well about a part of life that for so many people just raises more questions sometimes than it does answers. So thanks for taking some time, Brian, to join us today and for helping us kind of try to answer some of the questions that were submitted.
Gotcha.
One of the things is what we tried to do is we took all the questions submitted and we noticed there were three or four similarities that kind of popped up to the top as you look through them, and we gathered those into questions. So your one question is really about three questions,
okay?
But they all had like a similar format and tone to them, so that we kind of thought we could get through these as one long answer to the questions. And so I'm going to go ahead and ask you these questions in the three ways that they showed up with some connection. And the first was simply, is demonic activity still around today? And in other words, are demons present currently at work in our world? And how can we address that?
Okay, well, the fact is, when we think about the demons' activity in the world today, I'm going to go back to look at what Jesus does with the disciples. Jesus equips his disciples and sends them out, his very first followers, to confront demonic powers and deliver people from oppression. In Mark chapter 3, that's what we're told he intends to do. He gathered those he wanted to be with him so he could send them out. Mark chapter 6, he actually sends them out to do that. Luke chapter 9, again, reiterates the sending of the 12 out. And then in Luke chapter 10, the 70 are sent out, and they're all told to confront demonic powers and deliver people. Most Christians know the Great Commission that comes in Matthew chapter 28, where Jesus tells his followers that they are supposed to make more disciples and then teach them to do what he taught them to do. So there's supposed to be this. This suggests that Jesus expected an ongoing line of disciples who would understand how to be engaged and address demonic problems. Then when we turn to the book of Acts, we find examples of believers confronting and dealing with demonic problems, delivering others from the power of evil spirits. In Jerusalem, in Acts chapter 5, it says that people with demonic spirits were brought before the leaders of the church, and they brought deliverance. In Acts chapter 8, Philip has a ministry in Samaria, and it includes the delivering people of demonic oppression. And a couple of mentions of Paul in the book of Acts as well. So we see in the book of Acts, this seems to continue.
Yep.
Then when we turn to the New Testament epistles, we find several references, whether in Paul's writings or Peter mentions it or James mentions it, where there seems to be ongoing awareness that there are demonic problems going on in the world and Christians need to be engaged in that battle. Given that trajectory and seeing that there are no passages in the New Testament that lead to the conclusions that evil spirits have resigned, or the demons have taken a leave of absence, or they've abandoned their activity, or are somehow restrained from involvement in the human life prior to the final victory of Christ's return, I would have to say, yes, there is both biblical evidence and then experiential evidence that there is still demonic activity in the world today. Demons are present, currently active in the world today.
Yeah, I think that's a really good answer and a helpful way to take it and go, let's just track through the New Testament, which is helpful because we just came on the heels of Mark's gospel, and it's nice to be reminded, good to be reminded.
Yes.
After Mark's gospel and after Jesus' death and resurrection, we still see a lot of interaction, evidence, and even expectation.
His expectation that his disciples would do this.
Let's back up just a second.
Mm-hmm.
And clarify, which I think we'll do this and have already done this probably in other podcasts, but just about this subject we're talking about, but just to keep people in a similar understanding.
Sure.
Let's define the terminology.
Sure.
So we're talking about demons. We're talking about demonizing influence. We're talking about evil or unclean spirits or dark powers or, you know, fill in the blank. So as you think about those things, any clarity you'd want to make sure people are working from in terms of how to think about that?
Sure. I think, Kyle, I think that there's a popular language that used about demon possession, and it's common both in the church and outside the church. And personally, I think I'm a little cautious about that language. demon possession tends to have a kind of a Hollywood spin on it.
Yeah.
And in the New Testament, although a number of translations render the language demon possession, biblically, there's only two terms that are used to talk about the influence of evil spirits in people's lives. Mm. One is to have a demon, and the other is actually to take the noun form of the word demon and make it a verb. Someone's demonized. And so I'm cautious about using the language of demon possession because that suggests an ownership, which I don't even see borne out clearly in New Testament examples. In Mark chapter 5, where Jesus meets the guy who's under the influence of a legion of demons, apparently the man still has enough self-awareness and self-ability to actually move towards Jesus when Jesus comes on the shore. So I'm cautious about the demon possession language because I think it has captured, has a cultural spin on it that's probably not entirely biblical, but we could talk about someone having a demon, that is, the demon's presence, or they're demonized.
Yeah.
And so, there's a variety of influences that demons have on people, and perhaps the demon possession language is language that we might want to be cautious about using.
Sure, and that's part of why I think we decided to try to address this at some level in this way to kind of give a measure of clarity, because the lack of clarity is due to the almost Hollywood, like as you referred to, the Hollywood version of demon possession, which is everywhere in movies and this. But not just that, the perception we naturally come to because of that, even if we grew up in and around the church, is like it's a weird kind of out there.
Yep.
And the only picture or image we have of it has to do with this idea of like odd possession type visual.
So
That's helpful. And I wanted to make sure we clarified that because that helps the understanding of what you just unpacked in the New Testament. In light of that, then, the one of the pressing kind of questions that came about was, can a person be possessed in today's day and time? Or what would that influence look like in light of what we just said about possession?
Sure. I would say the same activity that was going on in Jesus' day and in the early days of the church is currently possible. It would then be right to conclude that, yes, people in our day and time could be demonized or have an unclean spirit. I would avoid saying they're demon-possessed, but and certainly demonized in some way. Specifically about looking at Christians, talking about the Christian influence. In James chapter 4, Christians are told to resist the devil and he will flee. Now that leaves open the question that what's going to happen if we don't resist the devil? He won't flee, that is the devil or other spiritual beings. And Peter writes in his epistle in 1 Peter 5 that Christians have an enemy. Your enemy, the devil, prowls about like a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour, but we're told to resist him. But again, that raises the question then, so that if a believer doesn't resist, can the devil do something? Well, he's not a toothless lion. He is not an ineffective. Paul can actually say that we're not unaware of the strategies, the schemes of the devil. So if the devil devours someone, what would that mean? Now, that language is only used, to my recollection, only one other time in 2 Corinthians, where Paul is writing about a man who was put out of the church and invites the church to welcome the man back so that he not, quote, be overcome by sorrow. So for someone to be overcome by sorrow doesn't mean they're under the dominating influence of sorrow, but it would mean that sorrow impacts and influences the way that they're going to be doing life. And so Paul doesn't want the man to be overcome by sorrow. Well, that's the language that Peter uses when he says, your adversary prowls about like a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour. That is, have a pronounced influence on. So clearly Peter thinks demons can do something to believers. And then I think about Acts chapter 5, for example, where Ananias and Sapphira, the way that Luke describes them, believers, part of the church, and yet they're living in such a way that Peter raises a question about them, their Why has Satan filled your hearts to lie to the Holy Spirit? Hmm. Now, none of these texts would make any sense, James or 1 Peter, or if, in fact, Satan can't do anything to believers,
sure.
that if there's no actual spiritual battle going
yep.
on, that might actually have an influence. So there could well be a spectrum of demonic influence in the lives of believers, from influencing Christians' thinking, where, in fact, then we're told to take captive every thought.
Yeah.
Sometimes a more active presence where, yep. in fact, there is going to need to be resistance or even intervention by other believers to bring some measure of freedom. The text would lead me to think that unbelieving people, as well as Christians, can come under the influence of demonic spirits.
Mm.
And this would not mean that every time demonic presence is, that we're aware of demonic presence, that it's going to require the kind of deliverance or intervention that we
sure.
see in the Gospels. But if there's a spectrum of demonic influence, at one end, intervention, deliverance, at another end, personal resistance,
sure.
I think we need to live with the awareness that there is this spectrum,
yep.
and the believing community needs to understand how to respond to it.
Yeah, I think the clarity there is helpful because it's helpful to eliminate, in one sense, the perhaps wrongful version of possession that fills mm-hmm. our hearts and minds when mm-hmm. we think about demonic activity. But it's also helpful to raise awareness to the fact that when we say a spiritual warfare is actually going on, when we say that we actually are in a battle that is, in one sense, not just against flesh and blood,
that's
right?
Correct.
If we believe that to be true, and we absolutely do, then we have to have real conversations about what influence can Satan attempt to have
exactly
in the life
right.
of a believer? What is he trying to disrupt?
That's
what
correct.
Would devouring look like?
Mm-hmm.
Those are helpful categories, so I appreciate you taking time to address that. And then kind of lastly, because these were all, in a sense, playing along in the same
mm-hmm.
lane, you know, does it exist? How could it affect a person today?
Mm-hmm.
And then how might we know? So
right.
how could we potentially know that someone is being
sure.
perhaps influenced by demonic activity in some way, shape, or form, or needs help in resisting or deliverance?
Sure. Now, there'll be another podcast, I think,
yep.
where someone will walk through the Gospel of Mark and we'll look at some of the evidence in the Gospel as to demonic presence.
Sure.
But I think that there's a variety of ways to think about it and an ability to be discerning. And the discernment comes because I understand both what the biblical tracts are, the biblical evidences are, and also a sensitivity to the spirits leading in the moment.
Yep.
I think both of those are necessary. Some physical illnesses might well, in fact, be the result of demons. In Luke chapter 13, Jesus meets a woman in the synagogue, and it says that she's bent over, apparently a physical illness, but it's a spirit that has actually done that. And in Mark chapter 9, when a man brings his son to the disciples and ultimately to Jesus, the boy has a convulsive disorder, and the spirit renders him deaf and dumb. So here we have a physical affliction that, in fact, has a demonic origin. And that would require an awareness that some physical, not all physical illness, but
yep.
some physical illness is, in fact, evidence of a demonic presence. There's nothing about the woman that you'd go, oh, her bent-over condition is demonic. But apparently it was. There are times when Jesus deals with what looks like a seizure disorder as if it's biological, and he brings healing.
Mm.
But here in Mark chapter 9, this seizure disorder is actually demonic. And so both an awareness of the kinds of things demons might do alerts me to, I need to be sensitive to
yep.
this. But then I also need the Spirit's help to discern, is this physical phenomena demonic or biological? Some spiritually distorted thinking comes from evil spiritual influence. And that's, in one sense, a little more easily discernible because it's contrary to the Gospels. So, for example, in Mark chapter 8, when Jesus is talking to the disciples about he's going to die, and this is part of the Father's plan, Peter says, no, we're not going to go that direction. And Jesus turns to Peter and says, get thee behind me, Satan. You're not setting your mind on the things of God, but the things of man. I don't think he's saying that Peter needs to be delivered. I don't think he's saying that Peter is demonized. But he is telling Peter that thought that you have there has come from hell. That thought has come from demonic influence. In Acts chapter 5, I mentioned Ananias and Sapphira. I don't think on Tuesday morning Ananias is sitting across from his wife and says, I've been having conversations with the Prince of Darkness. And he has given, no, I actually think the thought goes through his mind, and rather than bringing it in line with gospel truth, Ananias just gives into it, like what Peter gave into. And in 1 Timothy chapter 4, Paul writes and says there's coming a time when people will give attention to doctrines of demons. And I don't know that we actually think that theological thoughts or what we think to be religious thoughts might in fact actually be interjected into our thinking. I think that a lot of Christians think that they are impervious to spiritual influence in their thinking. But there's enough evidence in Scripture that suggests that, no, although Satan can't read my mind, and he's not omniscient, he or demons can in fact interject thoughts. So part of that is, okay, now are these things that I'm thinking original with me, or are they coming from someplace else? And the discernment comes because they're contrary to gospel thinking. They're not in line with truth. And then there will be, I think, as we're aware of the, shall I say, the spectrum of demonic activity, there might become moments where there is a more direct confrontational approach necessary. Recognize when there is evidence. And I, it's not the only evidence, because I've already mentioned the woman who's bent over. There's no clear evidence on the surface that this is demonic. But when you look through the Gospels and you look into the book of Acts, oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes, demonic presence is evidenced by supernatural knowledge or supernatural power. So Jesus' first encounter with a demon in the Gospel of Mark chapter 1, Jesus is teaching and everyone's impressed with his teaching, and someone stands up, a man stands up and goes, I know who you are. Jesus of Nazareth, you're the Holy One of God. Have you come to destroy us? And you have to ask, where does this man get this understanding? Well, that's supernatural knowledge. That was mediated through the man, but it comes from a demon. Or the man caught in the tombs that Jesus confronts in the tombs, Mark chapter 5. He's a guy who breaks chains. You know, that's supernatural strength. Or the account in the book of Acts about the seven sons of Sceva who are exorcists of a sort, and they confront a man who is demonized, and they say, in the name of Jesus whom Paul preaches, we command you to leave. And the demonized guy goes, Jesus I know, Paul I know, you I don't know. And this one guy falls on the seven sons of Sceva and beats them up, and they flee the house scattered, naked and afraid. All that to say, there are times when there is going to be evidence of supernatural knowledge or supernatural power, which would drive the believer to say, this needs to be confronted, and in the authority that is mine, because I am a co-heir, an heir with Christ, because the same Spirit that empowered Jesus now dwells in me, there's a confrontational approach that gets taken.
And we've talked about that. I think the need to keep exploring those things with people is real. And so limited time here on a podcast, but there's a, there is a really important, and I think this, if I venture to guess, it becomes increasingly important for us to understand the reality of spiritual warfare. It always has been. We've underestimated it at times, or we've over-elevated it in the wrong way. So there's a real beauty, but also power and significance to going, Jesus didn't leave us unequipped. Or ill-prepared, if we're willing to...
Or even ignorant of the battle, right? He intended his disciples to understand the battle is not theoretical, and the battle is not merely conceptual. The battle is against spiritual beings. We actually live in an inhabited world. And I think that most of us, most Christians, don't grasp that we live in an inhabited world. We're not the only inhabitants here. That not only, the author of Hebrews writes and says that sometimes people entertain angels unaware. Those are good angels. And so we don't recognize that we live in an inhabited world where angels might show up, nor do we understand that we live in an inhabited world where, in fact, fallen angels might, in fact, influence our lives. So,
but the disciples did understand that.
That's correct.
Jesus equipped that. They do understand it. They all write about it. When those who write all write about it in some way, shape, or form, which is, I think, very important for us to pay attention to. Thanks so much for joining us today, and may not be the last time we have to keep diving into these things. So really appreciate your time and thoughtfulness in helping us process those questions.
Glad to talk with you about it.